Good afternoon and welcome to Dialect for Sunday the 20th of June. Well, a big hello to everyone in Bristol and also Preston from Dialect Radio and even South America and America, we're told. This week, a very contentious new issue in Bristol, residence parking. We speak to Bernard Cook, who's part of a campaign group that is against residence parking. Is it just a money-making scam for the council? We also speak to Arif Hussain, from the Wimble Hill City Farm, and we're going to chat about that and find out more. We also have Secrets and Lies, read by Malcolm Grieve. The chapter this week is Missing Evidence. We'll hear more of that later. And we've also got the What's On, as usual, but as unusual, Jeff's away. So Michaela Dennis, our new presenter, is going to read that today for us. We're also going to hear from Colin Force. He's an old train unionist man, a railway engine driver. We're going to hear about his opinions about the new Tory government. But I'd like to go over first to Bernard Cook, who's here to discuss residence parking. Hello.
Hi, good afternoon.
Now tell me a little bit about who you represent as such. Who is this campaign group of which you are a part?
Well, it's a small campaign group. We've called ourselves Keep Parking Free. And I think there are two aspects to that. Partly keep it free, as in don't pay for it. Mm. And secondly, keep it free, as in keep the city sort of free, unregulated. I think a number of us feel there are enough regulations in the world, and this will bring a lot more. And right outside people's houses as well.
Right. I mean, in some places, particularly when it comes to sort of attacks on driving in the centre of London and such like, in attempts to control traffic, it's generally been regarded as very successful. I mean, isn't this just part of a wider movement of trying to solve traffic problems, really? I mean,
well, I think if it would solve traffic problems, that might be fine. One of our concerns is actually this could make things a lot worse. So we would certainly end up with quite a lot less parking spaces, as I said, more regulation, more cost, and if you don't actually see a very tangible benefit from that, it's all a bit of a waste, and things have gone backwards really.
Would we wind up with less parking spaces?
Well, we're arguing, as you know, against these proposals which have come from the City Council. The City Council now have admitted there will be less spaces. I think if you take any sort of system and you regulate it, formalise it really, then you lose spaces. It just happens.
So some people will be using sort of makeshift spaces, which will no longer be a regulated sort of space.
Yeah, effectively, and to some extent, people make the system work as it is. We're not saying it's a perfect system now. We're more concerned that it could be less perfect. But yes, people work things out for themselves.
Yeah.
And if you come along and try and make the system sort of watertight, if you like, then to some extent you mess it up.
I mean, a lot of people, you know, would say there are no spaces left because you can drive around and around for a very long time trying to park. So surely something has to be to be done to try and encourage people to think of other ways to.
Well, I think in a way, if as you say, that's the case, then people are already finding another way if they can't park. So in a way, it self-regulates itself now.
Okay.
But surely taking a lot of parking spaces away, especially in the evening when people do like to park close to their homes, that sort of thing, is a security issue, especially for ladies in particular, you know, in a sort of city areas that we're talking about, then, as I say, surely taking a load of parking spaces away isn't going to help.
Has it started yet in any areas? What's the time frame?
No, it hasn't started anywhere in Bristol yet. The City Council, about 2.5 years ago, made a massive consultation exercise. I think 53,000 households were consulted.
Right.
Pretty much every part of the city said no.
Right.
A couple of areas, the answer was more ambivalent. It was a very unfair consultation, really, in terms of the questions that were asked, the way they're asked, that sort of thing.
But how did they react to that negative response?
Well, across most of the city, it's been dropped. So that's democracy, at least. A couple of areas, as I say, were more ambivalent.
Which areas?
One was Clifton Wood.
Yep.
And the second one is Kingsdown. Clifton Wood, they've carried out some more consultation. Now that's been dropped. And so there's just one left where they're, well, we're awaiting the result of the final, what's called a statutory consultation in that area.
Right, okay. So, I mean, you're on a sort of a roll to victory. Is that how you feel?
No, not really. It's a lot of work. We could do without it, really. I think if you take the view that the system is not perfect now, but if something like this comes in, it would be less perfect, then really nobody just like people to go away and leave us alone, really. So it's not on a roll to victory. And I think there have been a number of people in the City Council who've been particularly keen to see this come in. So
what reasons do you think they had for being particularly keen?
I think one certainly is financial. Mm-hmm. If a scheme like this comes in, and then what you see is it gets rolled out across bigger parts of the city, then it makes massive amounts of money.
Okay, it's interesting you highlight. So if you think it does come in Kingsdown, mm-hmm. Do you think that then means, even though they've already turned down other areas, that it will slowly creep into other areas?
That's certainly the evidence in other
parts
of the country.
That's why you don't really feel like you're on a rolled victory, is that?
No, I think you have to look at each separate part of the city separately as well. So no, we don't feel on a roll to
What is wrong with the council making money? I mean, we're in a recession. We've got massive mm-hmm. cuts. This affects everything from, you know, education and hospitals. What's wrong with the council making some money?
Well, you have to ask the people that would have to pay the money, I suppose. That would be one way of looking at it. Secondly, if the council needs more money, then it has to be upfront and honest about it and say, we need more money for X, Y, and Z, be it schools or old people's homes, whatever the need might be. And then you have to say, well, we're going to raise council tax. You know, it shouldn't be taxation by the back door from people who pretty much wouldn't have any choice.
Right. Do you think it's a regressive tax in some ways? I mean, would it be the same in all areas? Would it be the same amount of money? And how much is it?
It is a regressive tax, certainly, because people who earn less end up paying a bigger percentage of that income in this tax. It would cost a two-car household in the region of £200 a year.
Right.
So £30 for the first car, £80 for a second car, some pay and display, visitor permits, and probably occasional parking ticket as well. So £200 thereabouts is about fair sort of price. That's quite a lot, especially in a recession, as you say.
What if your auntie drives down and decides to stay with you for a couple of weeks? What happens then?
Well, she would need the scheme has visitor permits as part of it, and if you live within the area, you would be entitled to 50 of those free of charge, and then you have to buy the next 50 for £1 each. So she would use up some of those permits,
right?
As would the window cleaner, anyone who comes work on your house, builders, decorators, plumbers, whatever it is. They're all visitors. So actually 100 permits, which is the maximum you'd be allowed in a household, starts to look not very many, especially if you're renting a house and there's four of you. That's 25 permits a year.
Yeah.
Take away the plumber and the whoever else. You're probably looking at one visitor every 2 or 3 weeks, something like that. So it's not very many. It's quite restrictive.
It's interesting that you mentioned sort of professional people in that. I mean, is this, if it's forcing people into public transport, maybe that's not always appropriate for a lot of people. Some people may need vehicles.
Some people do.
Yeah.
They surely do. And actually, before we came on air, we were just talking about medical students who will form a part of the community locally, who need a car. And because they have to travel to different hospitals, that sort of thing, very difficult for them, very difficult.
Is there a precedent for this in terms of other cities? I mean, what other examples are there of schemes like this, and have they worked?
There are examples in plenty of other cities. In some cases, they work. In some cases, they largely don't work. And the way we've seen it, and we've looked at other cities, Bath is a good example, Oxford is a good example, Exeter is another good local example. In a number of places, they simply don't work very well. The biggest reason is if you don't have enough spaces to go around, which is the case now, then giving everyone a nice shiny permit doesn't help really, because you still haven't got enough spaces. So you pay your whatever you do for your permit, and you think, okay, I still can't park. Actually, I certainly know people live in Bath. Exactly that situation.
Okay.
Residence parking scheme, fairly new scheme, actually, the last 5 or 6 years, I guess, and maybe a bit longer than that. And they can't park. You come home after going out for the evening, nothing.
Yeah. So once, if it was to be put through, they've sort of spent a lot of money putting it through, and people start complaining, the council might have to open a nice shiny new call centre to field all the complaints then.
Well, they might, and of course one of their arguments is that if it doesn't work, they'll take it away again. I think that's a very hard argument to make. There's almost no evidence of one being taken away somewhere, and I can't imagine it would happen here. So that's where we've come from, really. We've said we don't like this, we don't want it, please don't bring it in, and...
What's the time frame for hearing back about Kingsdown? What sort of?
Well, it's fairly short now. The last consultation, the statutory consultation, took place over 3 weeks, ending on the 4th of June, and we're expecting the results at the latest by the middle of July.
Okay.
So there's a cabinet meeting, I think the 22nd of July, where a decision should be taken. We hope enough people have understood the arguments, understood that actually this isn't good for the city, for the area, and have objected.
Okay,
and that the council listens to that.
Okay, and lastly, what can people do if they want to get in touch with the sort of the campaign group?
The best way is they can look at our website. It's very simple, keepparkingfree.org. It comes up right at the top if you Google Keep Parking Free.
Okay.
And go and have a look. There's lots of the arguments there, the reasons why it won't work. There's contacts there.
Bernard Kerr, thank you very much for coming in.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
I'd like to welcome our next guest now. It's time to speak to Arif Hussain from Windmill Hill City Farm. Hello.
Hi.
What do you do at Windmill Hill City Farm?
I'm the director there at the moment.
Okay. How long have you been a director?
Well, at the farm, I've been there since February this year.
Okay.
Basically, though, that it doesn't mean that I'm orchestrating the animals. We have a team of people that work there.
Yeah.
Farmers, horticulturalists, children's workers, play workers, etc.
Okay.
At the farm, and I support them in terms of delivering the services that we deliver.
Okay. And for the uninitiated, you are, if you sort of drive past the Asda in sort of Bedminster Way and sort of turn off to the left, you're somewhere up there, aren't you?
Yeah, if you drive past the Asda, as if you're heading down the A38 away from town, get to Mortimer and you take a left down there, which is St. Philip, which is Philip Street. We're just on the right-hand side there.
Okay. Why is it important for people in a city to sort of be in touch with animals?
I think Windmill Hill City Farm gives the wrong connotation that it's just a farm. For us, it's not just an animal farm. There's also green space there as well. There are animals there. We have animals such as two pigs, some goats, some pygmy goats, chickens, hens, ducks. But also there's 50 allotment places there. There's also a organic garden there as well. And there's also an adventure playground. and a 50-place nursery and a football pitch, all-weather football pitch as well, as well as a craft and training room.
Right, pretty big, pretty large place then.
Yeah, yeah.
What is the sort of history of Wimbledon Hill City Farm then? How long has it been going?
Yeah, it started about 1978 by local residents who identified a piece of derelict land that did previously have houses built on it. It became derelict, and they approached the local authority to sort of say, we can do something with this space that will be of benefit to the community. And they went down the sort of city farm road in terms of having animals and environmental kinds of projects there.
Right. Do you think that the chart, if somebody approached the appropriate authorities now, that they would say yes to a similar scheme? I don't know. I mean, imagine the property developer would probably snap that up pretty quick. Sounds like they were lucky.
Depends where it is. I mean, I'm sure you could ask about College Green.
Yeah. Get a couple of goats on there.
Yeah.
Quite nice.
There might be, yeah. I think nothing to stop you asking the local authority to do that. But I think you do tend to find out some fantastic farm and gardens projects out there.
Okay.
In Bristol, there's actually four city farms. There's St Werburgh's, Lawrence Weston, and there's also Hartcliffe. And ours, which is Windmill Hill, is actually sort of straddling Windmill Hill and Southwell Wards.
Okay, so when you arrived in February, what sort of state did you find it in, particularly financially, given the challenges of a recession?
The farm, prior to me getting there, had been through a huge fundraising campaign. Prior to Christmas, the organisation had to raise £50,000, otherwise the whole site would have closed. That would have been the reality of it. The community, the then funders and current funders from Bristol City Council and a couple of about three departments from Bristol City Council, Community Development, Children and Young People Services and Health and Social Care, also Quartet Community Foundation, the local residents, the users of the farm as well, the staff team there, and also some of the local press really supported the organisation, helped it in terms of its fundraising campaigns. People did a £25 donation when it got to a certain level in terms of £10,000 of value, then that was sort of helping towards meeting the target of £50,000.
Right.
And it did that with weeks to spare.
So you got that challenge obviously sounds like it proved an awful lot of people valued its place in the community.
I think a lot of people who donated have actually grown up as users of the farm, either when they were young children, because there is almost like you're there as young children to see the animals. Then you've probably gone into the nursery or used the adventure playground or the space there. As you've become older, and then as you've become even older, that we run a number of training courses there, which are community focused, so things like craft courses, beer making courses, etc., or brew your own cider. It's kept people engaged rather than it just being for one element of your life when you're younger.
Yeah. A common catchphrase at the moment is nature deficit syndrome, which an American guy coined. Who said he identified a syndrome where a lot of kids were just sort of tearaways. And if you put them a little bit in touch with nature and take them out of a sort of a bleak urban environment, then they sort of become different people and become a lot more rounded. So do a lot of kids, when they're using Wimbledon Hill City Farm, do you notice, do they come out of themselves? Are people sort of different, do you think, in the way that they might otherwise be?
I think with the services that we provide, there's a provision we provide there, the children use it with the children's imagination. I think some of the children love the animals and they will chase the ducks around, which our farmer isn't too happy about sometimes. But sometimes the children will stand on top of the breeze blocks that are kept by the old road there, and they sort of jump around on that because it's their imaginations and how they love to play. So it doesn't necessarily have to be nature.
Do you think there is a wider city farm movement, particularly of which this is a part?
Yes, there's actually a National Federation of City Farms, which is based in Bristol, which is literally around the corner from our farm. It's called the National Federation of City Farms and Gardens, and it provides support to, I can't tell you how many there are because I don't know off the top of my head, but there must, but there's hundred, probably goes into the thousands of city farms and gardens that this organisation provides like umbrella support for.
Okay, yeah, you mentioned allotments also. Is there quite a waiting list for your sort of allotments as there are with the rest in Bristol?
Yes, absolutely. We've got 50 allotments and we've got a waiting list of over 90 people wanting to come on use the space.
What's the turnaround like on those? I mean, do people start and think, oh, blimey, this is a bit harder than I thought it was, and then give up?
Our allotments are a little bit smaller than the city council ones, which are quite big. I think there's a long waiting list, and it's the reason, and it's not that our allotments don't come up that often. Probably about, in the 6 months I've been there, five months I've been there, probably about four allotments have turned up.
Okay.
I think even though we went through a real funding crisis last year and we managed to see ourselves to this end of last financial year, as an organisation, we're still looking at fundraising and ensuring the sustainability of the organisation. We're doing that a number of ways. Firstly, we're putting in direct grant applications to charitable trusts like Quartet, which is a local one that people might have heard of, or there are other ones across this nationally. I won't name any because it might embarrass them, but there are national sort of charitable trusts that give out money. We're also looking at restructuring the organisation to make sure that we're efficient and we modernise as an organisation, which has been some difficult decisions, but we have to ensure the sustainability of the farm and make sure that we can generate income ourselves with the assets that we've got. And thirdly, the other way that we're doing it is by doing family fun days and having events where people can come along, hear some great music, have some great food. Not a month ago, we had Cafe Matreya, and who did a community fundraiser with us where they did a fantastic barbecue with the Real Olive Company. And we had some live music on site and we raised nearly £4,500.
Right, okay. Yeah. I mean, there's clearly, in terms of the imagination of, you know, yourself and people running it, there's clearly still further scope for development, even despite the financial crisis. Is that limited by the amount of space that you've got at all, or...? Do you ever have any plans to possibly expand, or is there anywhere else you can go? I don't know.
We want to be able to develop and sustain the existing site. We have opportunities to expand, but it will obviously be limited by the range of activities that we want to do there. Mm. The greater number of activities that we want to do, the less we'll be able to use certain areas. There's not much other access to other land directly around the site at the moment because we pretty much take up that whole square.
Okay, yeah. So how would, I mean, you sort of indicated there might be a possibility that you sort of turn it into a little bit of a tourist attraction as well as community centre. I mean, would that be a danger that you might sort of commercialise the experience? How would sort of the locals interact with, you know, the people coming from outside?
I think it'd be very good for both. I think it's good, always good to learn from other people. I think as an organisation that is providing a service, we should be open to people, different people's perspectives about what we're trying to deliver. Mm. And that should challenge us and that should help us ensure that whatever we're delivering is meeting our, for want of a better word, customers' need. And our customer is not just the local community, but it's from visitors from outside the city as well.
Okay. Yeah. And what are you... hoping to achieve most as sort of director of the farm? What are you, you know, if you're still here in 5-10 years time, what do you hope to have achieved and changed?
What I'd like to see happen is that the farm stays in existence, but it grows and encourages more users in there as an organisation in the terms of different activities.
Okay. And are there any events coming up that are worthy of mentioning?
We are planning an event in August, probably the August 21st or 22nd, which is going to be our big fundraiser for the year, which will be an all-day event plus an evening gig as well. We probably do that with a local partner.
Okay, so watch this space on that one.
Yeah, we'll make sure we get publicity out and inform people about that.
Excellent. Arif, saying thank you very much for coming in and good luck and best wishes.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
One of our producers, Anthea Page, whose features and voice you may well have heard a lot, eagle-eared listeners, is on holiday at the moment, travelling around Europe. She's off to Bulgaria shortly, and I caught up with her on the telephone. So here is a clip of my little chat with Anthea about her and travels.
I'm sitting in a hut on a campsite in Santa Gorga, which is on the Danube Delta. And it's very hot here. We're watching the World Cup.
Okay, right. Who's playing?
Brazil and who else? I can't remember the other team. I'm not that... I'm not that interested, but anyway, I'm leaving here tomorrow and I'm making my way down to Constanza and Balchik in Bulgaria.
Yeah.
By bus.
Okay, how have you sort of found, you know, culturally? I mean, what are they today? Are they a little bit sort of Eastern European? Do they search all your bags and sort of ask you where you were going?
Actually, we found the people here incredibly friendly, really nice people. We've loved every minute of it. And they said the trouble is that people in Britain get the wrong impression of Romanians because a lot of the people that come to Britain are the Romanian gypsies. And, you know, they just think that we have a bad impression of their people and country. So I met an English guy who lived in near Bucharest.
Yeah.
And he said that he still thinks that the orphanages are still happening, but not so much.
Okay.
And that children were still living in the sewers in the city, but we didn't see any of that. But we did see some gypsy children that got on the bus, and they were really, like, out of control, really feral, quite scary. And the local people just were too frightened to tackle them.
Right.
So that was quite interesting. And the other thing is that they said that they want to cut 25% of the, you know, like in Britain, the workers, government workers.
Yeah.
Like all over Europe, they want to cut 25% of their wages. So.
Right, okay.
That's about all I've gleaned, really.
Okay. But you're happy so far? All good?
Yeah. I mean, it's we haven't seen much poverty. And it all seems very well organised, very clean, very, you know, great country, really.
That was Anthea Page, and we'll chat to her and get an update from her next week.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Well, here for you with half a brain, see if you can spot the link. This is Windmills of Your Mind, sung by Dusty Springfield from the late 60s.
Round, like a circle in a spiral, like a wheel within a wheel, never ending or beginning, on an ever spinning wheel, like a snowball down a mountain, or a carnival balloon, like a carousel that's turning, running rings around the moon, like a clock whose hands are sweeping past the minutes of its face, and the world is like an apple whirling silently in space, like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind. Tunnel that you follow to a tunnel of its own, down a hollow to a cavern where the sun has never shone, like a door that keeps revolving in a half-forgotten dream, or the ripples from a pebble someone tosses in a stream, like a clock whose hands are sweeping past the minutes of its face, and the world is like an apple whirling silently in space, like the circles that you find in the wind. Keys that jingle in your pocket, words that jangle in your head. Why did summer go so quickly? Was it something that you said? Lovers walk along the shore and leave their footprints in the sand. Is the sound of distant drumming just the fingers? Just
Dusty Springfield, that was Windmills of Your Mind.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
It's time for Secrets and Lies now, as read by Malcolm Grieve. The chapter this week is Missing Evidence.
Secrets and Lies. The Lowdown from David Southwell. The weapons for keeping things secret are many. One of the best tricks in the Secret Keeper's toolbox, even more effective than the lies of an official denial, or classifying something as top secret for 30, 50, or even 100 years, is the technique of destroying the incriminating evidence. Shredded documents are much harder to leak. Permanently deleted emails cannot be forwarded to journalists or be printed off and submitted in a court case. A convenient fire that destroys all records is often a politician's best friend. The best way to guarantee that there is no smoking gun for anyone to find is to ensure the weapon is sitting at the bottom of a deep river. It does not take an overly paranoid state of mind for a professional journalist or other researcher to become worried about just how often critical government documents appear to have been accidentally lost when you make a request under the Freedom of Information Act, or to wonder at just how many fires and floods there have been at national record centres. You can make a pretty good guess that you have been lied to and that secrets are being kept when crucial, incriminating evidence goes missing. However, without the hard proof, it is usually impossible to take investigations further and expose someone's lies or an insidious conspiracy. All you are left with is the mysterious coincidence that bits of the picture which would have landed someone in jail and resolved all the unanswered questions are nowhere to be found. Bill Hicks was not the type of comedian to have catchphrases. The closest he came to one was, "Back and to the left, back and to the left." It was a reference to one of the key controversies surrounding the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. As Bill Hicks puts it, "How come if he was shot from behind, the laws of physics get suspended?" And you can see his head slam back and to the left in the Zapruder film. The official version answered Hicks's questions by suggesting it was a neurological spasm that made Kennedy's head move backward and give the appearance he had not been shot from the direction of the Texas School Book Depository. It is an answer that does not satisfy many doctors. There is, however, an easy way to settle the matter conclusively. By examining the brain of JFK, it should be easy to determine from which direction he had been shot, and once and for all, resolve decades of wild speculation. Despite the fact that a naval medical technician testified on oath that Kennedy's cranial cavity was empty when the body arrived for autopsy, the official records show that it was sectioned and fixed in formaldehyde, the standard pathological processes that you would expect to happen. An examination of the X-rays, slides of the brain section, or the brain itself by a competent forensic expert would determine how many shots hit the president's head and from which direction they were fired. The only problem is that the president's brain is missing, as are the X-rays, tissue samples, and other elements of the autopsy report that could settle this matter. The controversial nature of the disappearing presidential grey matter is heightened by the fact that the doctors who first saw JFK's body when it was rushed to the Parkland Hospital in Dallas testified that all the evidence they saw supported the fact that he had received a frontal shot. This directly contradicts the naval pathologist who produced the official autopsy report. On the night of December the 21st, 1988, Pan Am Flight 103 exploded over the Scottish border town of Lockerbie, killing 270 people, including 11 on the ground. It later emerged that the plane had been brought down by a bomb placed in a suitcase in the cargo hold, making it the largest act of terrorism against the US before 9/11. The Lockerbie bombing was also Britain's worst air disaster, and resulted in Scotland's largest ever murder investigation. After a 3-year joint investigation by the Scottish Police and the FBI, Libyan intelligence agent Abdel Basset Ali Megrahi was charged with the bombing and in 1996 was eventually convicted of murder and sentenced to 27 years in prison. Nagging doubts remain over the case, especially when it emerged that key elements of the evidence had been destroyed. Many police officers were disturbed by the presence of Americans at the crash site, and were told by senior officers that they were not to enter material about American activity in their notebooks. In 2000, Labour MP Tam Dyel revealed that a former constituent, WPC Mary Boylan, had come to him to express her concerns over the destruction of police notebooks belonging to officers involved in the initial stages of the Lockerbie crash site investigation. Almost 11 years after the event, Boylan had been asked to give evidence to an inquiry over Lockerbie. So the retired WPC had phoned Livingston Police Station to ask for her notebook. She was told it had gone missing, despite the legal requirement to keep it safely stored. She then learned that the notebooks of Lothian and Borders police who had been at the crash site had been destroyed. In the House of Commons, DL asked who gave the instruction for the destruction of the notebooks in the biggest murder trial in Scotland. It was a question that was not answered. What happened to the remains of a suitcase belonging to Joseph Patrick Curry, a member of the US Army Special Forces, which Boylan recovered from the crash site, also remains a mystery. Like the police notebooks, it too is missing. Project Blue Book was the most important study of unidentified flying objects undertaken by the United States Air Force, running in various forms between 1952 and 1970. Its aim was to determine whether UFOs were a potential threat to US national security. During the course of its investigation, Project Blue Book collected, analysed and recorded more than 13,000 sightings. Originally, all of the reports written as part of Project Blue Book were classified, but over the years all files and reports have come into the public domain. The only officially acknowledged exception to this was a document called Estimate of the Situation, which, when it crossed the desk of Air Force Chief of Staff General Hoyt Vandenberg, was ordered to be destroyed. Vandenberg believed that the document's conclusion that UFOs were extraterrestrial craft was flawed and lacking in proof. As Project Blue Book's findings were published in a series of reports numbered 1 to 14, it seemed as if there was something else missing. Special Report 13. Researchers were bemused when there was a gap in the numbering sequence, jumping from Blue Book Special Report 12 to Blue Book Special Report 14. When the Air Force was first asked about the apparently missing report, they explained that the reason why there was no Special Report 13 was the same reason some skyscrapers don't have a 13th floor, the belief that the number is unlucky. Finding it hard to believe that scientists and members of the Air Force suffered from triskaidekaphobia, the irrational fear of the number 13, UFO researchers tried to find the missing report. One of the most reliable and professional researchers investigating UFOs, Stanton Friedman, was able to find evidence that the report had been written and was still classified. Faced with this evidence, the Air Force changed the official story and said that Report 13 did exist, but only in a draft form. Whether or not the Air Force were being honest at last, the report is still missing, and 13 remains an unlucky number for those wanting to know the truth. A few years ago, an actor asked the author to research Mary Pinchot Mayer for a film script he was developing. When he read the material accumulated, he decided to develop a different story. "No one would buy this, even though it's true," he said. "One person with all that going on is just not believable." The established facts of Mary Pinchot Mayer's life do make for incredible reading. She came from a wealthy Washington family and had the reputation for being one of the most beautiful women in the American capital. A talented painter and doyen of the city's party circuit, she was married to Cord Mayer, one of the CIA's top men. In 1962, Mary visited Timothy Leary, who was at the time conducting his pioneering LSD research at Harvard University. Her first words to him were, "I've come from Washington to discuss something important. I want to learn how to run an LSD session." Mary had already had her own LSD experiences and believed that the world would be a better place if men in power had LSD experiences. The plan she outlined to Leary was that she and a group of her female friends would take LSD with their husbands and lovers in the hope that they would achieve a different level of consciousness and start to work for peace. Leary and Mayer became lovers, and he agreed to help her with the plan without knowing that Mary was also one of the mistresses of President John F. Kennedy. When Mary was shot while out walking in Washington in 1964, one of her friends asked her sister Toni to find Mary's diary. When Toni and her husband went to Mary's studio to look for the diary, they found the CIA's Director of Counterintelligence, James Angleton, already looking for it. Finding it later, Toni discovered it contains details of Mary's affair with JFK, so she decided to give it to the CIA. The CIA has told researchers trying to obtain the diary that Angleton must have destroyed it, and therefore all evidence of Mary's LSD plan for world peace.
That's Secrets and Lies by David Southwell and read by Malcolm Grieve.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
It's time to hear from a man from Yatton. His name's Colin Force, and our Tony Gosling interviewed him. Colin is a trade unionist man, he's a railway man, he's an engine driver, and he spoke to him about the new Tory government. So here are some of Colin Force's opinions about the said Tory government.
I was born in 1933 on a Monday. My dad was a seaman and go abroad. He was a ship's carpenter. He was in his 30s. And on a Friday, I was October the 2nd, it was on a Monday. On the Friday, he was given the sack with hundreds of others. There's no ships, no trade. In America, it's a depression. Here it's a recession, but it's still a depression. Nearly 4 million unemployed. Anyway, 1938 comes along and things all of a sudden start to get better. But it's ruined by a flaming war, isn't it? 1939. Now, that started, I was going to be six in the October 1939, and the war started. Now, we had this wonderful war, and 1945 it's finished with. We had the VE Day, and then in Japan dropped the bombs. But now they can have this general election. And outside of the factory, which is gone now, Wakin Dean's factory, Mr. Rory Ewing is the Conservative MP for the Western Supermare constituency. And as far as I know, he's doing his speech, he's saying his bit. And there was lots of men there, and a lot of them wore their old battle dress. The badges was gone, but they were. And I can see him now. One bloke said, "You're not going to do to us what you lot have done prior to this effing war." Well, first of all, laugh as you may, I went home to my dad and I told my dad what this man had said. I didn't understand effing, all right? Not a nice word, he said. He said, "Well, son," and then he told me now about how difficult it was that he never went to work from 1933 to 1938. 5 years unemployed. They had to give the keys up because they was buying a house at South Liberty. Couldn't afford that. My mum got fined £5 because she couldn't pay the rates to Bristol Corporation. And I haven't got it. My brother has got the card where my dad had to go and do work to get certain foods. And one of them on there was margarine, not butter. We don't do that today. And that got me thinking. And I read as many books as I possibly could about politics. And then I used to ask questions. And all sorts of people. In this village, there were some wealthy people, there was farmers. And if you was interested, they would talk to you and give you their version. Anyway, the National Service, that come along, and I thought, and that was a Labour government that kept that going, mate. It didn't do us any harm. In fact, it gave us a whole new outlook on life. But, well, then the 1950s, it's begin to got a bit better and a bit better. And, of course, the National Health Scheme. And one of the things, I got this, 1940, I can remember not hearing anything, because I didn't live in Yatton in those days, air raid. But I could lip read, and I can remember the almoner in Bristol General Hospital asking my mother how much she could afford to pay. And my mum, I can see my mum now, and she said, "Half a crown." Well, bear in mind, mate, the wages was only about £3 a week, mate. Or less in some cases. I've never been biased, but the Labour that we've had just recently is not the Labour. I can't understand why employers, they expect loyalty from their employees, but they never reciprocate. Now, that was the one good thing about working for British Rail. The top management reciprocated. We used to have, for instance, trade union schools held at Babbacombe. They were subsidised, and you could take your wife, take your kids, and we went into a hotel down at Babbacombe, and it was the union would always invite British Rail management. So Peter Parker, there was a professor, somebody that's gone to Oxford, there was Chris Green, all sorts of top management, and they would come down and tell us their problems. And then we would have a chat, really friendly, no shouting and hollering it, but and then at the end of the day, you had an understanding of other people's problem. But see, it's like now with this British Airways thing. I don't know about being a steward on an aeroplane. I haven't got a clue. Preferably, I don't think I would like the job because it's too confined to my... But I don't know what their duties are. British Airways, that boss, he's not really interested in the workers and paying the wages. All he's interested in is paying his shareholders. And the shareholders are not suffering any pain at all. Well, if you're having difficulties, which the airline is, then that's the time that the workers and the bosses should cooperate, not cut one another's throats. Now, we've lost another 150 million, so they shareholders is going to lose out anyway. And then you hear this clapped up about the number of cabin crew that have been on strike for 10 days and have lost £2 million in wages. Christ, 10 days? It's so sad. And now, with the country have said, right, Mr. Cameron and Mr. Clegg, you've got a so-called put it right. But notice now, and I'm not biased, but notice how the public spending got to be cut, but not a word about the people that caused the problem. Not a word about these big bankers. And they're the people that caused the problem in the first place. So why aren't they paying their share then? If we're going to have pain, everybody have the same pain. And that's why it's so unfair, see. And I'm afraid that whatever Mr. Cameron is going to do, he got two choices. He can either pull this country up by his boots, or at the end of 5 years, he would wish he was never born.
That was Colin Force, a retired train unionist from Yatton, as interviewed by Tony Gosling.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
It's time to welcome the What's On Guide, usually by Jeff Sparks, our very own man in black, usually clad with a Sepultura t-shirt. We've got somebody a little bit more colourful to read his What's On Guide this week. Hello, Michaela.
Hi there. Good afternoon, everyone. And this is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Thursday, 24th of June, and Bucky will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7pm and tickets are £4 in advance and £5 on the door. On to Friday the 25th of June, the Wurzels, a local favourite, will be performing with support at the Tunnels near Temple Mead Station in Bristol. Doors open at 7:30pm and tickets are £10 in advance. Also on the 25th of June, Knuckle Dust will be performing with support from Prowler, True Valiance and also Crossbreaker at the Croft in Stokes Croft. That's also in Bristol. Doors open at 6pm and tickets are £7 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I present Vic Reeves. This is from the album titled I Will Cure You, which was released in 1991, and the track is Dizzy.
I'm so dizzy, my head is spinning like a whirlpool.
Vic Reeves with Dizzy from the album I Will Cure You, which was released in 1991. On to Saturday 26th of June, Steve Payne will be performing with support from Cazelle at the Prom Bar in Gloucester Road, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £6 on the door. Finally, on the Sunday 27th of June, Lee McCrory and co will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Clifton in Bristol, and the gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. So that's all from Jeff for this week, read by Michaela. Thanks for listening, take care and goodbye.
Thanks, Michaela. Well, here's an interesting fact for you. If you go see the Wurzels these days, three of them are actually from Scotland, which is a bit interesting. Well, that's all for this week's show. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM across Bristol at 12 noon every Sunday. If you're on broadband internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or download our podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. You can also find us at bristol.indymedia.org every Friday morning. Or if you're outside Bristol, you can listen live on the internet at bcfm.org.uk. Thanks to our studio guests Bernard Cook and Arif Hussain. Reports this week were Tony Gosling, and we heard from Anthea Page also, travelling around Europe. Studio production this week was by Johnny Royden and Michael Reid, and the producer was Tony Gosling. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production. That means anyone could contribute. Like Michaela, who only came along today for the first time, and why not read the Watson Guide? So if you'd like to, either in reporting or engineering, or you'd just like to come along and watch us, please contact Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, or you can find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and this is John Peters Coleman wishing you a very good week from all the team in the Queen Square Studio in Bristol. Take care, and until next week, goodbye.